in our jurisdiction. I do want to say that I'm extremely honored because of the distinguished panel that I have today of widely acclaimed experts on corporate governance. What I intend to do is to ask each of them to make introductory remarks for about 10 minutes. I'll introduce each person as I call upon them to make introductory remarks. And then I'd like us to have an interactive session. And so as Joanne was pointing out, it would be ideal if all of us were really sitting in the front and in the middle, so that it's easy for us to go through some of the survey questions that I will be asking through the session. So for those of us who are sitting in the back, in addition to Joanne making you say the, I'm not going to say it because I intend not to to be the one who has to say it at the farewell dinner tonight. I do think it's useful for us if we're all sitting together and up front. And it's also easy for us who are in the panel to see you, because it's not very easy to see you if you're behind the middle and up front. And so please try to make your way through to the front if you can. It is important for us to start with a common understanding of what corporate governance means today. And so what I'd like to do is share a few definitions with you, which I believe capture the essence of corporate governance today. Sir Adrian Cadbury notes that in its broadest sense, corporate governance is concerned with holding the balance between economic and social goals, and between individual and communal goals. The governance framework is there to encourage the efficient use of resources and equally to require accountability for the stewardship of those resources. The aim is to align as nearly possible the interests of individuals, of corporations, and of society. The incentives for corporations and those who own and manage them to adopt internationally accepted governance standards is that these standards will achieve their aims and attract investment. The incentive for the adoption by states is that these standards will strengthen their economies and encourage business probity. The Commonwealth defines corporate governance essentially as being about leadership. Leadership for efficiency, leadership for probity, leadership with responsibility, leadership which is transparent and which is accountable. And the Turkey Capital Markets Authority says, with respect to Turkey, sound corporate governance means improvement of a country's image, prevention of outflow of domestic funds, increase in foreign capital investments, increase competitive power of the economy and capital markets, overcoming crisis with less damage, more efficient allocation of resources, attainment and maintenance of a higher level of prosperity. As often outlined, the common principles of corporate governance are transparency, accountability, fairness, and responsibility. And all of this must be respected in order for firms to build and sustain the confidence of all stakeholders and society at large. I hope you agree with these common themes around what corporate governance represents and what it should capture today. Let me start by asking Judge Mervyn King to give us a much more holistic perspective on what the new order should be. As you will note from page 41 of the conference program, Judge Mervyn King is an internationally acclaimed expert on corporate governance. He's of course the chairman of the King Committee of Corporate Governance of South Africa. In addition, he's advised on corporate governance issues in, I believe, 43 countries. He chaired the UN Committee on Governance and Oversight. He's the chairman of the Global Reporting Initiative, and he's a member of the World Bank Private Sector Advisory Committee on Corporate Governance. He's a former judge of the Supreme Court of South Africa. He's professor extraordinaire in the University of South Africa on corporate citizenship. I've decided to call you Judge King today because I could call you Professor King, Dr. King, and Global Citizen King, but Judge King, over to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for pointing out all my titles. It's caused confusion in the past. When I was chairing the United Nations Committee on Governance and Oversight arising from the oil and food scandal, the people in the then Secretary General's office, Kofi Annan's office staff, weren't quite sure whether to call me professor or judge. So I used to get correspondence, professor/Judge King. And my air tickets were also issued in that fashion. And one evening I was flying from London to New York, the United Nations, and on British Airways, and the plane took off, and the air hostess came round to offer me the first drink, and she had an East London accent, not our East London, a sort of Cockney accent. She came around, and she looked at the passenger list, and I saw her looking quite querulously at it. And she said, "Oh, Professor Judge King, what would you like me to call you, Governor?" So many of you will know the Governor of the Bank of England is Mervyn King. So for 8 hours, I was the Governor of the Bank of England. Well, I'm not here in that capacity. I'm here in my capacity to talk about corporate governance, which is a passion close to my heart. I've practiced corporate law for over 40 years. I've been on the bench. I arbitrate and mediate internationally on corporate affairs. And I believe that the governance of corporations is critical in what Aranma has described as the new world order. Well, just to put it into context and understand it, we need to go back to the 1860s, when the concept of limited liability was started. By statute, our forefathers, were able to create a person, juristic, but a person, the same as you and I are persons, separate from the various stakeholders linked to this juristic person. And entrepreneurs took their businesses and put it into this juristic person, and thereby ring-fenced risk from their personal estates, subject to their not acting recklessly or fraudulently. Well, of course, this juristic person is totally incapacitated, inanimate, and technically is immortal. But it is incapacitated, inanimate, until you and I, as individuals, are appointed its directors and managers. So we, as directors, become the heart, mind, and soul of this person, this juristic person. And the company of the 19th century, certainly until the middle of the 20th century, was not the company of today. The large companies today, the multinational enterprises of the 100 largest economies in the world by way of gross revenue, the majority are multinational enterprises and not governments. Some of these great multinational enterprises operate in more than 150 countries. So the impact which their operations have on numerous societies and environments is patent. We also have a new world order in the sense that we have new capitalists. I, for 11 years, chaired the settlement arm of all trades and equities on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and the derivatives and financial market and the bond market, which was discussed earlier. And when one does a beneficial download of that, or in London or New York, wherever, one finds an extraordinary thing, that the majority shareholder today, the provider of capital, is not the wealthy family anymore. It's not the Rockefellers in America. It's not the Oppenheimers in South Africa. It's pension funds and financial institutions. And that's your money and my money. So one of the extraordinary things of the New World Order is that we have a whole new civic economy. That you and I are the providers of capital, but we're also the customers of these corporations. At the Global Reporting Initiative some 4 years ago, we did a survey of the stakeholders of some of the top companies in the world. One of them was Daimler AG, the manufacturer of the Mercedes-Benz motor car. And we asked them, what do you expect from your company? And the answer was, well, we expect a quality product. And when we buy a new Mercedes in 8 or 10 years' time, we expect it to be a quality product. And also to have innovative mechanical attributes. At the time, we translated that to mean that having created trust and confidence in a stakeholder, in this instance, the customer, a director has to maintain that trust and confidence in discharge of his duty of care to the company. The question is, how does one do that in the milieu in which we find ourselves today? I call the decade of 2000 to 2010 the decade of stupidity. The reason for that is that in the year 2000, certainly, there was the World Summit of Leaders called because the planet was in crisis. It was appreciated that it was. And simplistically, what came out of that World Summit was that the solution probably lay with business. Because business today has a greater impact on the planet than governance. And those companies that carried on business as usual during the decade of 2000 to 2010 were members of the decade of stupidity. Now, why do I say that? Well, let's see what happened in that decade. We all got to know that we had reached ecological overshoot. Sustainability speak for the fact that our forefathers, believing it was in our best interests, had mechanized everything during the Industrial Revolution, but had used the natural assets of planet Earth faster than nature could regenerate them. And that continued until this very day. The second thing is that we realized there was climate change. But what happened in 2007, 2008, we had the global financial crisis. So the New World Order, people directing companies around the world, had to consider a milieu in which we had a financial crisis, a climate change crisis, and an ecological crisis. And directors who thought they can carry on business as usual and make more with less, because they have to make more with less, simply because at the moment we have approximately 7 billion people on our planet. And those of you who have read some of the works that I've written, I have described our planet, our Earth, as planet inn and hotel, because you and I expect to board and lodge in it. And at the moment, in hotel terminology, we have no vacancies. There are already food security problems, water scarcity. And by 2045, the UN extrapolation is we're going to have at least another 2 billion people. So can one even logically think that you can carry on as usual in that context, in that milieu? I believe not. Yesterday's economic model was based on two false assumptions. That planet Earth had limitless resources, false, they're finite. Secondly, that the planet had an infinite capacity to absorb waste, landfills, hundreds of thousands of landfills around the world. The largest landfill in the world at the moment happens to be in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Google it, It's the size of Texas. Extraordinary. That's what you and I have done to the planet. We also know that the book value of companies, the way we were all tutored and taught, certainly as a corporate lawyer, reporting in corporate legal and accounting jargon, as if the only user of the annual report was the investment analyst. That was yesterday's game. We have come to learn that governance, how we steer and direct a company, that's the board's duty, and how management implements that which the board decides, and that whole strategic thinking forward, long-term, of the company and sustainability have become absolutely inseparable. A board today has to identify the sustainability issues pertinent to the business of the company and incorporate it into its long-term strategic thinking, as water is to the beverage manufacturer. The Coca-Cola Company, one of the world's great multinationals, some 9 years ago started their long-term strategic thinking of replenish, reuse, and recycle water. And they claim by 2017 they'll, quote, close the loop, not waste 1 liter of water. Was that to show all of us who drink Coca-Cola what a good corporate citizen it is in order to protect its brand? The answer is absolutely in the affirmative. But it was also to show Warren Buffett and the trustees of your pension fund that they can make an informed assessment about the sustainability of this business long term and can, with some confidence, discharge their duty of care to you to invest in the equity of that company. And it's a matter of logic. If we report, as we've all been taught, just the financial report with a sentence on prospects for the future, very difficult in the context of this new world order, this new economy, this triple crisis which I've described to you, to make an informed assessment about the sustainability of that business. Today, corporations have to report on how their operations impact both positively and negatively on the society, the environment, and financially. So we get this holistic representation in order to make decisions in a planet which is in crisis. And the world has come to appreciate this. Scandinavian countries have already legislated about this, creating a paradigm in which their corporations can operate, but reporting on the impacts which they have on society and the environment. The UK Companies Act has been amended to incorporate that, the German Commercial Code. At the Accountants Olympiad in Kuala Lumpur in November last year, 6,000 accountants met. And I'm a corporate lawyer, but I was a speaker there. But the conclusion at that meeting was that corporate reporting was financial reporting as corporate reporting was yesterday's game. In July last year, an historic event occurred. A meeting was called in London in which world bodies met. There was the chairman of the big auditing firms, four big auditing firms. There was the Global Reporting Initiative. I represented it as its chairman. There was the International Accounting Standards Board. There was the International Auditing and Assurance Standards Board. There was IOSCO present in the form of Jane Diplock. There was the World Wild Fund present in the form of John Elkington. There was the United Nations Development Program. There was HSBC. There was Nestle. But more importantly, there was the Financial Standards Accounting Board of America, the FSAB. The accountants in the audience will know that the debate has raged for years about the convergence of standards according to IFRS and standards according to FSAB. And yet within an hour, we had an identity of purpose and thinking at that meeting that the future was integrated reporting. Integration of how the financial impacts on the non-financial and the non-financial on the financial. If you look, just imagery, the financial reporting river has been flowing strongly. The environmental social governance / sustainability has been a stream, with tributaries feeding in. But as we in the last decade have realized that we are operating in a context of crisis, those tributaries have gathered strength, and that stream has become a river in itself. Those two rivers, there's a confluence, and there's that integrated reporting. The highlighting of the annual financial statement, the highlighting of critical issues in the ESG as water is to the beverage manufacturer, in clear and understandable language, so all the users of the annual integrated report can understand it. And on reading it, one can draw the inference quite clearly that this is a sustainable business going into the future because the board has applied its collective mind to the sustainability issues relevant to the business. Unilever, Procter & Gamble, two of the world's great multinational companies, have issued their 10-year scenario plan only in November last year. They will, in the next 10 years, not be on the main grid anywhere in the world, and we all use their products. They'll all be running their factories on renewable energy. From an R&D point of view, they are manufacturing, will be manufacturing their products. So you and I will use their products using 50% less energy, 50% less water. Apple, going back, looking at its suppliers. There is now responsible investment code springing up around the world for the trustees of your pension funds to look at the ESG factors in a business before investing your money in order to discharge their duty of care. Traceability has become a critical issue in decision making. Ask Nike, who forgot about the traceability, what it could do to a company when it was discovered their shoes were being made by child labor. So supply chain codes of conduct have become critical as well. And that has to be looked at before your trustees invest your money in the equity of a company. The International Integrated Reporting Committee, of which I happen to be the deputy chairman, we hope by June this year to issue a framework which companies can work internationally to do integrated reporting. The Johannesburg Stock Exchange, following recommendations in King 3, has made it a listing requirement that our companies do integrated reports. And the World Federation of Exchanges will meet in October this year here in this conference center. And members of the WFE have been present at this conference, and they have said it's on the agenda to discuss at the conference as a recommendation to stock exchanges around the world. Well, what are the other trends in governance? Alternative dispute resolution is absolutely critical. We operate in a flat, borderless, electronic world. Jeffrey Golden spoke yesterday about educating judges, an enormous task. Having been a judge of the Supreme Court, I can tell you, having sat as the chairman of a CSD for many years, I could make a much more informed decision today than I could have made 11 years ago. So education is important. But alternative dispute resolution mechanism is being built into corporate life more and more. ADR clauses recommended in employment, supply, and any contract the company concludes. So you can negotiate, mediate, and have an expedited arbitral decision by an expert in that field within 60 to 90 days, depending on the terms of your contract. This also drives the disputants to talk. Internal audit has changed completely. It's become a highly skilled issue, risk-based, with reports coming up to the board about the adequacy and efficiency of controls. So the board can, in a context of knowledge, make the statement, which we all sign as directors, that the controls in the company are adequate and effective. For years, as directors of large multinational enterprises, directors have been signing that with respect in a dark hole, because the knowledge is in the bowels of the company. It has to be brought up to the board. We have combined assurance as a modern governance trend. We have the first line of defense, certainly as a non-executive director, the veracity of management in the pack that you get, internal controls, and of course the external audit check, but all operating together on a combined basis. Information technology and information security, a critical governance factor today, because IT is not an enabler anymore. It's pervasive. It's in the very fabric of our businesses. Remuneration, a critical issue. Remuneration perform it today is being related and will be related in future to performance as how the corporation impacts not only financially, but also on society and the environment. That will determine the bonus. That will determine the level of remuneration which is being put to shareholders for a non-binding vote of approval almost around the world today as a governance trend. So let me just conclude by saying this, Ranma, that today we all should, as directors and managers, have an interactive strategic communication with our stakeholder groups. We need to understand their needs, interests, and expectations. We have to take this into account in our decision-making process. The more we understand the needs, interests, and expectations of our stakeholders, the more informed management can operate, the more informed a board can strategize long-term. It's not a question of how much money the company has made anymore. How has the company made its money? Has profit been made by impacting adversely on the environment, society, and human rights? These are questions being asked today. The customer of today and tomorrow is not the customer of yesterday. Young people's mindsets have already changed. My 8-year-old grandson said to me the other day, "You must have a huge carbon footprint. You're always in airplanes." I asked him, "Where did he get this from?" "No," he says, "we learned this at school." That's it. When I launched my latest book, Transient Caretakers, a year ago, which is about how to make life on Earth sustainable, at Q&A time, a young woman stood up and said, "Professor, I just want to tell you something. I've got a 14-year-old daughter, and she insists on going to the supermarket with me. When I'm about to take a product off the shelf, she says, 'No, no, you cannot take that product. It's not eco-friendly.'" That's your customer of tomorrow. And that is the reality. So we have responsible investment. We have traceability of input products. These are two market forces impacting on how we govern, how we direct, and how we manage companies. To put it colloquially, we have to, in our corporate reporting, say what we do, do what we say, and then document it. We can no longer solve 21st century challenges and problems with 20th century methodologies. We cannot do it. Integrated reporting is a concept whose time has come because of the crises of our time. You can stop armies, but you cannot stand a concept whose time is right. Thank you very much.
Is anybody not convinced that we have a new world order? I'm even more passionate about the new world order, hearing the things you've shared with us, but particularly what your young grandson said to you. I think we should make him a regulator so he can regulate all these companies around the world. Or maybe he's already a regulator since he regulates his grandfather. Thank you, Judge King. Professor Kofi, our next panelist. Professor Kofi is the Adolf Bell Professor of Law in Columbia University Law School. He's also the director of the Center on Corporate Governance. And as you will see on page 43 of the program, he has served as a distinguished visiting professor and scholar of law in several universities around the world. I want to add something that is not in the presentation that I got to learn about him before meeting him today. He's done several research pieces that are very distinct. But for us as securities regulators, if you haven't looked at the research piece about the link between, or the linkage between, a strong enforcement regime and the cost of capital, I encourage you to do so after this. If you Google his name, you will get a copy of that research piece. Professor Coffey, I'd like you to, in the thoughts that you share with us, to cover issues around executive compensation, because I do think it's part of the new world order, and some of the new trends that come out of the implications of the Dodd-Frank Act in the US, the whistleblower bounties that the US SEC has started to share to encourage people to come forward, and other thoughts that you may have. Okay. And I'll give you 10 minutes as well.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm happy to follow, delighted to follow Dr. Professor Governor King, Your Majesty, because I think there's considerable continuity in what he's saying and what I'm going to say in a slightly different, more economic language. A key question before this panel is, what explains the balance between mandatory law, law of the you shall do this or else variety, versus more voluntary law, sometimes called soft law, which consists of codes, best practices, and which is backstopped usually by the familiar European comply or explain principle. And in which direction are we moving? All one way, all in the other? My answer will be a little bit provocative. I think that one of the key facts about corporate governance is that there are areas of corporate governance where actors can impose costs on others. That is, they can externalize costs while reaping the benefits of their activity and avoiding the full social costs that they create. Economists call this the problem of externalities. And the classic standard example of externalities is the problem of pollution. Shareholders can engage in polluting activities to make them a great deal of money through the corporate form without having to bear the full costs. And yes, as Dr. King was saying, good directors should oppose that. But the incentives are there for shareholders, if they act in a purely economically rational way, to engage in risk-creating activities without bearing the full costs, and that gives shareholders the wrong incentives. Now, what I'm going to say today, to link up what was being said yesterday with today, and I hope this is somewhat provocative, but I think it's definitionally true. Systemic risk is another externality, just like pollution, because shareholders can engage in risk-creating activities that are highly profitable without bearing the full costs of systemic risk when the crisis arises. A systemic risk crisis, like 2008, imposes most of its costs on creditors, employees, fixed interest claimants, and ultimately on the taxpayer. The simple truth is that for a systemically significant financial institution today, the real residual risk bearer is not the shareholder, but the taxpayer, because of the familiar too big to fail syndrome. The bottom line from this is that shareholders do not, at the outset, have the proper incentives or the proper motivation to avoid a systemic risk crisis by taking adequate precautions, because they do not bear the full costs. Instead, they may continue to pressure for higher leverage, for higher risk activities over the short run, because, again, very bluntly, the fastest way to increase the profitability of a financial institution is to increase its leverage. Now, this may be rational for shareholders. It's not rational for society, and we have a mismatch here. How do we address this mismatch? Well, it is the tendency of legislators, particularly including the U.S. Congress, when addressing externalities, to turn to corporate governance reforms. That may be putting the square peg in the round hole together, but it is a classic tendency. And let me illustrate what went on with the Dodd-Frank Act. The diagnosis, both in the U.S. and the U.K. and much of Europe, of what was the underlying cause of the 2008 financial crisis. And there were many explanations, but the most popular one with Congress was misincentives created by incentive-based compensation. Compensation that allowed managers to accrue huge bonuses without worrying about the long-term consequences. And you could look at some very large financial institutions in the years 2005, 6, even 7, where officers two or three levels below the chief executive were capable, did in fact, earn bonus compensation of up to $100 million a year by closing the maximum number of asset-backed securitized transactions in that period. Once that happens, another word from economics becomes relevant, and this is the word moral hazard. If you can make $100 million in incentive compensation over 1 or 2 years, you don't need to worry about the long term and what will happen to those transactions 5 or 6 years down the road. You can take the money and run. As a result, this was at least the diagnosis of Congress and regulators around the world, much attention has turned to incentive-based executive compensation. Dodd-Frank shows you two approaches to this problem. I would call one the wrong approach, the other the right approach, but I think we're always going to see a combination of these approaches used. In the Dodd-Frank Act, the U.S. Congress responded to the problem of systemic risk by essentially adopting the standard agenda of corporate governance reformers. That agenda seeks to shift some power from managers to shareholders to make managers more accountable to shareholders. Across most of the corporate world, I fully endorse that agenda. But banks are different because the externalities are greater. This standard agenda has basically three elements, all of which are in the Dodd-Frank Act. One, something called proxy access, which is a procedure by which insurgent shareholders can place their nominees on the corporation's proxy statement to be voted on by shareholders against management slate. Side by side, with equal dignity, you'll see management slate and the insurgent slate up to 25% of the seats on the board. That is meant to give shareholders more power, and it does. It's currently being ferociously resisted by the business community in the United States, and litigation is pending, and the rules are currently stayed. Step two of this agenda is say-on-pay advisory shareholder votes on executive compensation. Great Britain has had this for many years. It's hardly a radical reform. But what you may not fully appreciate in the United States is it does shift a good deal of power, slightly invisibly, to a new actor in corporate governance, the proxy advisor, who we may talk about later. And the proxy advisor, it's not quite clear who the proxy advisor is accountable to, and now we have another hidden element in terms of what's going on beneath the scene. The third element that was endorsed and codified by Dodd-Frank was the elimination of broker votes. Most shareholders in the United States and elsewhere hold their shares in street name, in the names of the broker. And the broker used to be able to vote those shares almost uniformly for management's nominees, thus putting votes in management's pocket. Dodd-Frank ends that. But in ending that, understandably, it shifts power to institutional investors, particularly including the new proactive hedge funds, which do have incentives to pursue higher risk-taking and whatever will maximize the short-term market value. Now, all three of these changes, each of them understandable, shift power at least marginally from managers to shareholders. Is that a good idea? If the goal is to increase managerial accountability to shareholders, it's a fine idea. It's the classic idea underlying most corporate governance. But if the goal is to reduce a major financial institution's exposure to systemic risk, it might be exactly the wrong approach because it enables shareholders to put more pressure on the corporate managers. And how do shareholders do this? Let's be realistic here. I'm not talking about shareholders pressuring or threatening management. I'm talking about them using greater and greater amounts of incentive compensation to make managers more risk-tolerant. There's a basic truth underlying most corporate governance, which is that shareholders are much more risk-tolerant than managers. Shareholders are diversified, and they have limited liability. They don't have to bear all the costs. Managers are generally not diversified, and they have their human capital invested in one firm. Thus, their careers rise or fall with that one firm, and they much more fear the insolvency of that firm. But managers can be, in a word, bribed into acquiescence in shareholders' preferences with sufficient levels of incentive-based compensation. Now, at this point, let me play the academic and introduce you to some recent empirical research by financial economists, which I think is the most important research for regulators in the securities field to be aware of. This research, done by financial economists, it's been done now by several teams of them, but it's most commonly associated with the name René Stultz, a financial economist at the University of Chicago. It surveyed all of the world's major banks and what happened to them in 2008. And these studies, now done by several different teams, come up with two rather provocative conclusions. Looking worldwide, they find first that the more shareholder-friendly a financial institution's corporate governance is, the worse it did in the 2008 financial crisis. Secondly, the more the CEO's incentives were aligned with those of the shareholders through incentive and stock compensation, the closer the financial institution came to bankruptcy or became bankrupt in 2008. They tell us to be a little cautious about saying, always we want more shareholder-friendly corporate governance, because shareholders, at least in a world where hedge funds are the straw that stirs the drink in corporate governance, shareholder-dominated corporate governance may be, in the case of banks, a force that can lead to excessive risk-taking. Okay, so what should be done about this? How should we respond? Well, the U.S. Congress, first of all, moved towards greater power to shareholders, possibly a dubious strategy, although I understand why each of those principles was attractive. But they also took another step, a mandatory step. And this is where we come back to our question about the balance between shareholder-friendly voluntary steps versus mandatory law. Another section of Dodd-Frank requires that all financial regulators in the United States, including the SEC, must review incentive-based executive compensation at covered financial institutions, just at covered financial institutions, to determine if those compensation systems create excessive incentives for risk-taking that could cause significant losses. To that end, the SEC and other financial regulators adopted new proposed rules in March, just 3 or 4 weeks ago, under which these covered financial institutions will have to determine first which employees, quote, have the ability to expose the institution to possible losses that are substantial in relation to the institution's size, capital, or overall risk tolerance, close quote. Then, these proposed rules prohibit incentive-based compensation that would, quote, encourage inappropriate risks by the covered financial institution by providing covered persons with excessive compensation, close quote. Now, that's a very paternalistic rule, not voluntary at all, and we have yet to see how it will be implemented and enforced in detail. There's an even stronger rule for those banks that fall into the too-big-to-fail category. Under these proposed rules that are now still not adopted, 3 or 4 weeks old, any bank that falls into the too-big-to-fail category, that is $50 billion or above in assets, must hold back, defer, at least 50% of all incentive-based compensation awarded to senior executive officers for a period of at least 3 years. And the deferred amount would have to be adjusted for actual losses or declines.